So, Dom here from Winston's Wish with our second podcast, and I'd like to introduce you to Johnny. Johnny's kindly agreed to talk to us about his experience of his brother's death. Johnny, over to you. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and your experience, if that's okay?
Yeah, I'm Johnny Sharples. I'm a normal, regular person, really. No one in particular. But 3 years ago now, my older brother, who is 8 years older than me, took his own life just before Christmas in 2014. And ever since then, what I've really been doing on a personal level is to try and raise awareness of men's mental health issues and the sort of almost commonness of suicide, especially in men. I think often it gets swept under the carpet, the stigma, not just in mental health itself, but especially around suicide and in the aftermath of suicide, sort of gets brushed under the carpet a lot, and it's something that people don't want to talk about. So I've really sort of made it a personal aim and a personal mission of mine to try and get people talking a lot more about suicide, and to sort of end that stigma and get more people talking about it, and hopefully that should see a reduction in the numbers of people that are sort of keeping it to themselves and seeing no way out other than to eventually take their own lives. So that's sort of what I've been doing ever since my brother passed away.
Yeah, and I suppose we're on the tail end of that at Winston's Wish, where we support families who have been bereaved through suicide. And I think it's something that mirrors what you said, Johnny, is that lots of people don't want to talk about it. So people who, feel now that they can't share what happened, or the response that they get from other people is people not knowing what to say, or that look of shock. So I think there's the point that you made about not sweeping things under the carpet, letting people know that they can talk about mental health and talk about the thoughts that might be worrying them. One of the key facts we've got, or stats that we've got, is that suicide is one of the biggest killer of men under 50 in the UK. And I'm not sure what it is kind of recently, but we've got a figure of 12 men take their life every day in the UK. So are those kind of stats familiar with you, and what you kind of are aware of and talk about?
Yeah, definitely. It's something that I had not come across any of those statistics until Simon did pass away. And I think you do see a lot of the time, you see things get talked about, like cancer and heart disease and things like that, and they're really worthwhile causes and really worthwhile charities, but they're sort of things that everybody is familiar with and everybody knows about. And I think a lot of the time people aren't aware of the statistics around suicide and sort of how commonplace it can be and how frequently it happens until it happens to them or happens to somebody they know or somebody they're close to. And sort of those statistics can be really shocking and jarring because it is so common, but it isn't something that's spoken about as if it is so frequently occurring. So I think, I think it is 12 men every day on average. I think just over nearly 5,000 men a year, obviously. The 75% of them are men, so there are a number of high number of women taking their own lives as well. And it is the biggest killer of men under the age of 50 in this country. So, like you say, it does happen a lot, but it also gets swept under the carpet a lot. And I think the main way to sort of avoid that and to avoid the stigma is to get more people talking about it and to sort of get more familiarity around it. And sort of the more it's talked about, the less taboo it becomes, and the more people are getting comfortable talking about it. And hopefully the end result will be that those figures come down and it does become more and more preventable with more people talking about it.
Yeah, and I think within the families that we work with and the groups that we facilitate, where young people can meet other young people and parents can meet other parents, where suicide has happened in their family, we advocate that they can talk and they can share and they can think of how they cope and process that information. It's a real realization for me, whenever I'm on a group, is how men don't generally talk about everything that's going on. So if that's a cultural thing or whatever's influencing that, I think there's been a lot of campaigns recently about, and I've heard you say it before about men being told that they have to be men or boys being told to man up. I just wondered what your kind of reflections are on some of that too.
I think it's one of the I think it's one of those things where it sort of slipped into the vocabulary of everyday speech, something like man up, or like, stiff upper lip, things like that. They become so frequently said that they sort of lose the true meaning of what is behind them, and I think that becomes a real issue because the sort of the real meaning behind man up is, a man should do certain things, and there's certain expectations of what men do and don't and should and shouldn't talk about. And I think with the sort of the stiff upper lip culture and the man up culture, the real message behind that is that men should hark back to an age where men didn't burden anyone with their problems and just, they went to work, they earned the keep, they came home to their wife, who'd been looking after the children all day, that cooked the meal. It's very old fashioned, very, not the sort of society that we live in anymore, and we live in a much better society than we used to, and there's more, opportunities for people to do things and stuff like that. And so the change that should happen with that, with, obvious changes in, like, starting with, more people going out to work and the end of gender roles and things like that, is that men should be free to talk about their experiences and talk about their feelings and not have to feel worried that that will make them seem less of a, quote unquote man. And, there is no sort of gender norms anymore, and that's a good thing. And men should be able to talk about whatever they want. And part and parcel of that should be them talking about their feelings. And people should be prepared to listen to a man when he talks about his feelings, because men go through a lot of stuff that everyone else goes through. They go through divorce, they go through, loss of job, they go through bereavements themselves, they go through all sorts of things that can have a negative impact on their mental health, and they do need an outlet to be able to speak about that. And so when someone's telling someone to man up, they're basically saying, keep them problems to yourself, no one wants to listen to them, be quiet. And that just leads them to fester in your own mind and to you just to go over them and over them. You're not getting anyone's advice, you're not having an outlet for it. And all that does is just, pile each issue on top, each problem on top of one another until the weight just becomes too much. And a lot of the time that can lead to, mental health breakdowns. It can lead to sort of just dropping everything and running away, and it can ultimately lead to suicide as well. So I think just that small phrase, it's a butterfly effect. It's the thin end of the wedge, whatever cliche you want to use for it. But it's just the start of a problem that can snowball and get further. So those two words to a lot of people might just be two words, but to some people they might be the difference between a telephone call to a loved one and, taking their own life. And it's obviously not that simple, but it can lead down that path. And I think people do need to watch their language, and people are often worried about that kind of thing and like the PC culture gone mad and blah blah blah, and we should be like old-fashioned men. But
All
we
Welsh
shouldn't, we
trilby hats and
yeah, and walk around with a cane and go to work and leave your wife at home with her apron on and whatever. And that's not the case anymore. And men should be free to discuss about their problems. And like you say, the only way to do that is to end the stigma around, men's mental health problems and mental health problems as a whole. So yeah, like obviously those two words have a lot of weight behind them, whenever they're used.
Yeah, there's a number of young people that I speak to, and quite a few on groups that have kind of talked almost about a redefinition of kind of what it is to be a man, and to know that a man doesn't have to be like stoic or strong or not talk about his feelings. Just mirroring what you said, I suppose, that it's you're not any less brave because you're crying, or that you open up or you share that worry that's going on. And I think that's something we really kind of amplify with young people, is that, if you just keep your worries to yourself, who's helping you deal with them? So being able to get some support or just have a chat or do something nice in terms of coping strategies, like to do something that makes you feel better, or a chat with someone that you like that can give you some positive vibes. Or yeah, playing on Championship Manager, I was going to say as well. Thinking about your experience too. Something I wanted to ask as well. How do you remember Simon? Do you kind of have a daily kind of thought with him, or do you kind of mark special occasions or anniversaries in different ways? And how important do you think that might be?
So Simon was sort of it's really strange because they're sort of my life while Simon was alive, and then it's sort of like the BC AD marking of dates, so the way that we operate our calendar, it's like there was while Simon was alive and there was sort of after Simon passed away, and they're two different chapters almost of my life, and I had to feel like I had to grow up very quickly. I was 28 when Simon passed away, so it feels strange to say I had to grow up at the age of 28, but I think I was a young 28. But like, I have so many memories of Simon because he was there for 28 years of my life. Being an older brother, sort of, I think it's similar to sort of your parents. They're always there. They're there from the minute you're born to, you expect them to always be there, or to be there for a large chunk of your life. And so I just cherish every memory that I have of Simon. And he does pop into my head every single day. It could be sort of sometimes it's just in passing, like I've got photographs of him around the house, and I'll just see a photograph and it'll just make me smile to see a photograph of him smiling, because that's the way I remember Simon. I just always remember him smiling or laughing or throwing a sarcastic remark around, because that's the person that he was. And it took me a long time to sort of come to terms with the fact that in my mind Simon always smiled, and he had the biggest smile that I think I've ever seen on anyone. And then it sort of counteracts with the stereotypical image I had in my head of what a depressed person would be like, or what a person that would take their own lives would be like, and that never seemed like Simon. So that took a lot of sort of wrestling within my mind. And I still don't know if it is resolved in my head, but it gets better every day, every thought that I have of him. So I'd like everything that I do reminds me of him, sort of, because he's always there. He was part of so many different times in my life watching football. He took me to my first football match. I watch football every week, so that's always a reminder of Simon. Like playing computer games, me and him we'd play Call of Duty when we were like a bit older. We played Championship Manager when we were younger. We'd play FIFA. We'd play like Formula One racing games. We'd do everything, that sort of thing. So every time I turn an Xbox on or turn my laptop on to play Football Manager, it's a reminder of Simon. And there's sort of all these reminders around, and it's sort of looking for the positives in those memories that I was lucky enough to be involved on Football Manager when it was 20 years old. I took part in the documentary. I appeared in that. And that was a real privilege for me to do. And if it wasn't for Simon introducing me to that game, I'd have probably never had that opportunity to be in that documentary. So it's taking those little memories and trying to put a positive spin on every single one of them, because, I could play Football Manager and it could be a real downer that sort of, oh, Simon introduced me to this, and sort of, I don't think I can play it anymore because it's such a negative sort of vibe that I get from, remembering when we were sat together playing it. But you try and put the positive on that, and memories can be happy and sad at the same time. I always think back to the film Inside Out. I don't know if you've seen it.
I'm a big
It's
Disney
a
fan.
yeah, it's a really, I think that's the perfect film for sort of people to, especially young people, to sort of understand their emotions and how they work together. But I saw that as like a 29-year-old, 28-year-old, and it's still like the impact on it where, she realizes that memories can have, joy and sadness at the same time. And that's sort of how memories of Simon are. There's sort of a sad aspect that he's not here to sort of relive those moments with, but the positive aspect that he was here and I had those memories to make with him.
We were talking about kind of remembering Simon and how you can have happy and sad memories that are combined. Every happy memory and the things that you enjoyed can also be sad in terms of him not being there and not being alive to experience that with you, but having a positive spin on all of that is something that sounds like really helpful to you. I'm interested, like, to see how you kind of experience anniversaries and things, because there's the day to day remembering someone, and those kind of positive connections that we speak to families and young people with about, even though someone's died, you can still have them in your thoughts, or be reminded of a memory, or think, you know, what would Simon have done in this situation, to ask for advice, for example. So, sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, like, anniversaries, there's really three particular anniversaries that stick out in my mind. One was obviously his birthday, and so every year, the last birthday that I shared with Simon, in April 2014, I went round to where he was living, with a Colin the Caterpillar cake, which I think he was 36, which on his 36th birthday seemed like the most appropriate cake of all to get him. So every birthday subsequently since he passed away, I've bought a Colin the Caterpillar cake and just shared it with the people that have been with me on that particular day, whether it's work colleagues or my partner or anyone. It's just nice to go and get a cake, maybe blow up a couple of balloons, and just really sort of remember the person he was, and remember the birthdays, and remember the last birthday that we shared together, because it was a happy occasion. You know, birthdays are always are quite a nice occasion to spend with people that you love and you really want to be around, and I don't think that should really change because the person's not here anymore. Like, I shared loads of birthdays with Simon, like from when I was born to his 36th birthday, a number of years later. We had a lot of birthdays together, we had a lot of cakes together, but it's really that Colin the Caterpillar cake birthday that would stick in my head, so it only seems right to sort of carry that tradition along. Similarly, Christmas, Simon absolutely adored Christmas. I lived with him until I moved out of my parents' house, and then I lived with him again for about just under a year when I was a bit older, while I was looking for somewhere else to live, and he did not change around Christmas from when he was like 13 or 14 years old until he was in his like mid-30s. Like, Christmas Day would come and he would still wake up at like 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning excited to receive Christmas presents, and he would bang around the house trying to wake everyone else up so he could open his presents, whether that was 6 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning. You're bleary-eyed if you went out on Christmas Eve and got a bit tipsy. He did not care if you were hungover. He just wanted to open his Christmas presents, and that never changed. And so Christmas is a nice time to remember Simon as well. It's a difficult time, I think, Christmas, because there's a real sort of tradition for families to be together on Christmas Day. And I think, you know, I remember the first Christmas after Simon passed away. It was only four or five days after Simon died. Sort of still being with my family, being with my mum and dad and my sister, and sort of looking around and sort of knowing that Simon wasn't there to celebrate with us was a sad thing. But knowing how much Simon loved Christmas and how happy Christmas would make him, sort of, especially in maybe not the first Christmas he passed away, but the subsequent Christmases since then, sort of really fill you with a positive spirit, like Simon would be loving Christmas Day, so, you know, it's only right that we should really be celebrating Christmas as well, and really having a good time. And still on Christmas Day, I still have the last Christmas present that I bought for Simon, that he passed away on the 21st of December, so we never got to exchange them, but I still have it wrapped up. And every Christmas since then, I still put it under the tree. It's sort of a little Christmas decoration, but it's just a memory that Simon still has a present under the Christmas tree. And, you know, he's not going to come and get it. If he does, then something's gone on. But he's never going to be able to have that Christmas present, but it's always nice. You know, everyone else in the family has a Christmas present under the tree. Like, I'll have them, my parents, my sister, nephews, nieces, my girlfriend, you know, everyone has a present under the Christmas tree, so it's only right that Simon should still have a present under the Christmas tree as well, because at the end of the day, he's still my brother, regardless of you know, him having passed away. So he should still, you know, have that present as well. And it's those little things, those little reminders and little memories to make sure that he isn't forgotten, and, you know, we remember him when we're together as a family. It's really nice to sort of have those sort of memories of him as if he was there with us, and we can indulge in sharing the memories of him and what he was like on Christmas Day, you know, 20-30 years ago, or what he was like, what he would be like on Christmas Day now, getting excited to open that present and share with us. So, you know, memories and special anniversaries and occasions, they can be very sad. It's still very sad on the anniversary of the day he did pass away, and I think that's the most difficult one of all, because that day is just a random day. It's not like it's a Christmas day or a birthday where there's other events going on. It's just the 21st of December, and there's nothing else special about that day apart from the day that we found out Simon passed away. So that's probably the most difficult one of all to put a positive spin on, because, you know, it's not a birthday, and you're not getting presents, and you're not really, you know, having that spin on it. So I think on those sort of days, on that anniversary, we try and get together as a family, or get together with his friends, or, you know, a mixture of both, or everyone, and sort of have that day to remember Simon with no other distractions. So while the positivity of Christmas Day and a birthday can be a good spin on things, it is also a distraction away from the memory of who you're trying to think of. Whereas on the anniversary of his death, it is just all about him and all about Simon and all about sharing in those memories, without a sort of prejudice of like having to remember it in terms of a Christmas or in terms of a birthday. You're just remembering it in terms of Simon with the people that you love and the people that he loved, and, you know, really coming together and celebrating and remembering him for the person he was.
Yeah, and I think every family that I speak to do different kind of rituals or traditions, or come up with their own things that make more sense for them. And some things are kind of celebratory of someone's life, but also having an element of space for sadness. And I think what is quite common with lots of families, it's that search for finding something that feels good to remember their life and not just memorialize their death, which an anniversary is bound to do, isn't it? It's the date that is significant, because it's the date that they died, and that's a really important part of their life cycle. But it sounds from what you were saying about all of those things, there's ways of finding happiness and joy and remembering the memories rather than just the day taking over. I was just wondering, like at Christmas, who runs around and wakes everyone up now then?
I have two cats, so it tends to be them. But I imagine before too long, you know, I've got nieces and nephews, and before long, the Christmas spirit, they'll come to understand that that's a day you get presents, and they'll definitely take that mantle on. Whether they do it into their 30s like Simon did is, you know, there's only time will tell, but I'm sure they'll take over from him in that respect.
Yeah, true. I think some young people are pretty good at waking up adults. I think that's a given. I was thinking about something that we spoke about before, Johnny, about you've got a nephew who you were thinking about your worries about how you share, or what knowledge he might grow up knowing about Simon and his life and the way that he died. I was wondering what you could share, or what you feel okay to share about your thoughts about that.
Yeah, so my nephew was I think three, four when Simon passed away. So he didn't really have an understanding of what had happened. He knows the sort of the words to use, not suicide, but I think, death and dying, and understands that he's not around anymore. But the sort of the way in which Simon passed away, it does leave me personally with worries about how he will grow up to understand that, especially sort of in that sort of middle ground where he sort of has an understanding of what has happened, but sort of doesn't have the fully formed sort of social awareness yet of what that really means, and why sort of depression happens, and why ultimately suicide may happen. So it's that sort of middle ground that you sort of worry about. And as a family, we're sort of his mum and people like that are really doing well to keep alive Simon's memory, with photographs and sort of little trinkets and little gifts that Simon had bought him throughout the years, have them up in his bedroom and things, and he can look at. And they're really good at keeping sort of anniversaries together and sharing videos and things like that. But I do think there is a sort of a worry, especially around suicide, of society as a whole sort of doesn't have a grasp on why suicide happens, I don't think, really. I still think there is a common trope of that it's a selfish act and things like that, which isn't helpful and I don't think is at all true. So whether sort of as a young person growing up having to acknowledge that, whether that's the sort of overlying message that they sort of suddenly come to realize ahead of the message that, it's a complex thing and it's a sort of a last resort and something that people don't just do one day, wake up deciding to do one day. So I do hope that he gets the support that he needs in growing up, and I know that charities like yourselves are really good in sort of helping children understand why it's happened and how to sort of resolve it within themselves as well.
Yeah, and I think it mirrors what you were saying about it being an open dialogue and being ready and prepared for when those questions happen, because it's inevitable that he will care about his dad, and wonder like how he died when he's old enough, you know. Sometimes what we say is that the questions that come when children ask them, it's because they're already thinking about possible answers. So to be able to break it down like you are about talking about men's mental health and how, it's all about putting everything into context about Simon, I suppose, isn't it? That, yeah, it's his life. And I know that we probably don't want to delve too deeply into talking about that. But I think, yeah, being open and honest with children and thinking, yeah, what support can I have and who can I soundboard about having this conversation with young people? That's where kind of Winston's Wish and different organisations can help. Yeah, I don't know if I talk too much then. What do you think?
No, yeah. So I know what you mean. Like, I think that it's sort of, especially as sort of an uncle or as a grandparent or as a like surviving parent or an auntie or what have you. You're usually at least 15, 20 years older than the child that you're speaking to, and it's sort of trying to level things on their terms. So you don't use. I don't think you should be using sort of graphic terminology to describe things anyway, but especially to a child, like there's ways of tailoring explanations to them. And I think the worry is as an older person is whether you have the right vocabulary, which seems strange, whether you know the right terms and the right level to aim the what you're saying at to a child. And that's where I think, charities like Winston's Wish come in, and they're really acutely aware of how children's minds may work and what methods may work best for a child. And I don't think there's any harm in a parent or a grandparent or an auntie, uncle, what have you, in sort of relying on the help of a charity to explain those things to a child, because
I think,
they have the experience of doing that
Yeah, I
more
think.
than a parent would.
Yeah, I think like what you were saying, Johnny, about just the semantics of man up, that might have so many different meanings to different people. So in a young person's mind, not just thinking of a very young person, but as you learn new words or you hear new things, you might have multiple different ideas about what that means. So if I was to say, mention the word suicide to a 10-year-old, one 10-year-old might have an idea about what that is, but another one might have lots of different ideas about how someone might take their own life because they might have already heard about it or spoken about it. And I think so many people don't know what to say because we're not born with a kind of book of what are the right words to use. So like you were saying, it's using the language that the children know, and if you're introducing new words, we help define it and we help kind of give it context and give it meaning. Rather than just throw these kind of words out there and expect children to know what we're talking about. Because depression is unique as well, isn't it? It's all of those things. I try to think of life as, individuals are unique because of all of their unique influences that make them who they are. And so is grief, and so is anything like a diagnosis of depression or the multiple reasons why someone might be in a position where they take their own life too. And I suppose I've used it throughout our conversation as well. We use words like, or phrases like, take their own life or ended their life, or some people are really, I think it's a cultural thing, like you said, people don't say suicide, and it's only in the last like 5 years or 10 years or so where people are talking about it and not saying it's c committed suicide, because it's not a criminal act, it's yeah it's
Yeah, that's like I say, like earlier on, like learning about the statistics around suicide after Simon passed away, and never really giving it any thought before. So the language around suicide is another thing I'd never thought of before, and it's only sort of when you become aware of it that, like you say, like committing suicide as a phrase is something that is being sort of encouraged to be phased out. And before Simon passed away, it's never something that I'd have given any thought about, and probably used regularly when talking about people in the public eye that had passed away, and just using it as sort of an easy to reach phrase, whereas I hadn't thought of the semantics around it. And like you say, it is when you sort of delve a bit deeper, something that needs to be examined a bit more. And that's true of a whole lot of words that are used around depression and suicide and things like that.
Yeah, and like you were saying, it's a cause of death that is so common, so why are we not talking about it? Well, we are. I suppose what I was thinking as well, is your kind of your passion or drive or motivation, whatever you want to call it, about promoting kind of mental health awareness. Can you give me a sense of, or whoever's listening, hello listeners, about some of the things that you've done. So I was thinking about what you support, how you support Calm or the Football Manager stuff too.
So the first thing that we did as a family when Simon passed away was to arrange his funeral. Obviously, it's one of the first things that happens, and we decided, in light of what had happened, that and in light of who Simon was. I know we said about earlier on, like, there's no gender norms anymore, but Simon as a person wasn't really into flowers. And so the traditional thing for a funeral is that people bring along flowers. Companies that he'd worked for would provide a bouquet, the family would give one, a wreath would come from his friends or something. But we decided that wasn't who Simon was, and that's, not the memories we had of Simon. So the better thing to do, rather than get money for flowers, would be to get money for a charity. And so we sat around together and sort of looked what sort of charities that we could find that Simon would support, or we could support in light of what had happened. And one of the first ones we came across was a charity called Calm, which is the campaign against living miserably, and they are really focused on ending the stigma around men's mental health, particularly given that the statistics that we talked about earlier. And so our initial aim was to just raise about £200, which is what we thought the friends and family would raise for flowers anyway. And the Just Giving page that we set up is still going now, and I think it's around, I think it's over £5,000 that we've got together. So we've sort of met our target quite quickly and then just sort of ran away from it. And the thing that my dad decided to do was to sort of, I know on Just Giving, if you're familiar with it, you set a target, and once that target's reached, you can increase your target further and keep going and keep going and keep going. But what my dad decided to do was to keep the target at £200, and people can see, like, this is what people think about men's mental health. You know, we only wanted £200, and people have raised £5,000. And because people are so shocked about the statistics and figures, and because Simon was so, you know, well liked amongst his friends, and his family loved him a lot, that we just keep giving money. Like Christmas and Christmas and his birthday, me and my sister and my parents still donate a bit of money, what we would have spent on his birthday or Christmas presents. So that was the initial thing that we did. Whereas sort of in the aftermath of Simon's death, you touched on Football Manager before. A grieving process is incredibly unique for each individual person, and a way one person would deal with death is completely different to the way another person might deal with it. And that was particularly true for my immediate family. My mum and dad, they found a lot of sort of a place to grieve in their faith, and they went to church, and their congregation of their church were really good and positive around them, and that allowed them to sort of express themselves and find positives and encouragement in there. My sister, she had a child, and so she could sort of focus on my niece and, you know, around there. And for me, I played a lot of Football Manager, which is a computer game where you take on the role of a football manager, and you can manage any football team in the world and take them to global domination. And that's what I did with a team. That's what I did with Celtic. And when all the real players on the game retire, so
Other
when
football
Messi,
teams are available, by the way.
yeah, so when Messi retires, Ronaldo, whoever you want, Ibrahimovic, Rashford, Matt Ritchie, all those sort of players retire, the game repopulates itself with fictional players, but each individual person's game will repopulate itself with a unique set of players. So what happens on my game will not happen on anybody else's game that's playing it. And one of the players that came through was a Croatian footballer called Ivica Strok, who was I signed for Celtic, and he scored over 1,000 goals in his professional career, and I absolutely adored him, and he's what kept me going playing Football Manager every day. Load it up, see how many goals he could score this time, see how many goals he'll score in that one, can we win another Champions League? And that's what really kept me going and kept my mind sort of focused, and gave me a place to escape to when the whole sort of grieving process was happening. And so I created a Twitter account for him when I was bored, and when I was trying to sort of focus my mind on something else. And that got a lot of followers. And then we created a fictional football program for his testimonial match when he retired. And we sold those over eBay and through his Twitter account, and raised money for Calm that way. And then because it's so unique, it got a lot of publicity, and sort of a lot of people noticed it. And so I've done articles in like the Financial Times magazine, have written about Ivica Strok. The Sun have written little pieces about him. It's been in the Scottish newspapers up in, you know, around Glasgow, where Ivica Strok would live. So it sort of, you know, got all this attention and focus. And the real sort of drive behind Ivica Strok as a whole, as being sort of a personality in the media and things like that, is because he's raising money for a mental health charity in such a unique way. And I think people run marathons for charities, but everyone that runs a marathon Although they probably should, because there's so much good stories and backgrounds behind why people are running marathons for certain charities. Each individual person that runs a marathon doesn't get sort of the publicity around them that they should, but that Avicii hasn't had around him, and speaking about him as if he's a real person. The whole reason why people are so interested and so intrigued about it, and why we can push men's mental health into the public eye in that small way, is because it is so unique and it is such a strange little weird thing. So that's been really the main way that we've tried to raise money for Calm,
yeah.
Doing that. So yeah, like I say, it was a way to grieve. It was a way for me to sort of come to terms with what had gone on, and it was a way to sort of focus my mind on something that wasn't solely focused on Simon for a small period of time, and to grow from that to raise money and awareness for men's mental health charities has been really positive and really nice thing to do, and a lot easier than running a marathon.
Yeah, it's like the inside out analogy. It's a bit of joy for something that is, yeah, has been kind of a vehicle for grief, you know.
Especially because, like I said earlier, Simon was the person that I would play Championship Manager with when I was younger, and he was the first person to introduce me to that game. And to be able to raise money and awareness for charities using those sort of lessons, where he guided me through the menus and told me what to do and told me the best way to play and the best players to sign, to be able to sort of remember Simon that way whilst also raising money and awareness for mental health charities, and also, you know, have fun along the way, like creating a football program and it going in the National Football Museum for like 6 months. It is such a privilege and such a great way in my mind of remembering Simon.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we talk about a lot in kind of our family meetings, but also on our groups, is that that element of fun is really important, and that way that although someone really important has died and grief is, you know, unique and challenging at the best of times, actually finding the positives and finding the and exploring the ways, different ways that you can cope with grief and manage grief and turn it into a positive can be a really helpful thing. It's been really amazing talking to you, Johnny. Thanks for being so kind of so open and willing to talk to us. I hope you found it an okay experience.
It was good. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I suppose what we want to end with is that a bit of a statement of our support for families who bereave through suicide. We run a national helpline, which is 0800 220021, and that's a free phone number, and the helpline's open from 9 till 5 on Monday to Fridays, and that's any family or professional who are working with a young person that would like to hear about how to support them. We also have a specialist publication called Beyond the Rough Rock, which is specifically for families who've been bereaved through suicide or someone taking their own life. Check it out, and have a look at us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all of those things. I know all of those things. Johnny, thank you so much for your time. Make sure you look after yourself tonight. You're going to play Champ Man tonight?
I don't know. I'll have to ask permission from my girlfriend and the cats if I'm allowed.
That's the right answer, I think. Cool. Thank you, Johnny. Cheers, mate.
Thank you very much for having me.